Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. Pets are beloved members of our families today, lavished with treats, toys, even elaborate little outfits. Yet the humane treatment of animals is a relatively new concept in human history. In the mid-1800s, horses pulling carriages were beaten in the street. Cities drowned their stray dogs, and circus animals were abused until they performed for our entertainment. That all started to change after the Civil War, as activists campaigned to change not only our laws, but our attitudes about animals. The journey from possession to man's best friend is chronicled in a new book, Our Kindred Creatures: How Americans Came to Feel the Way They Do About Animals. Authors Bill Zwasik and Monica Murphy join us now to talk about it. Monica, Bill, welcome to All Sides.
Hi.
Hi.
Bill, you're a New York Times Magazine editor, and Monica, you're a veterinarian. What brought you together to write this book?
Well, we're married, we wrote a book together about 10 or so years ago on the history of rabies, and we thought that that was such a great experience, and we decided to do it again, and really decided to focus on one particular time period, the late 19th century, when so much about animals changed.
Your book introduces us to many different characters over the course of these decades, but three in particular stood out to me. The first was obviously Henry Berg, who founded the ASPCA, which, if you don't know, stands for the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty Towards Animals. Berg has an awakening, if you'd call it that, while in Europe. He's in his 50s, he's working as a diplomat in Russia for the Lincoln administration, and he's horrified by the way carriage drivers whip their horses. What was different about what was happening there versus what was happening in the United States?
Really, nothing was different. The abuse of horses in cities around the world was really rampant during this time. But for whatever reason, this particular evening, Berg was inspired to jump out of the carriage and confront a beater of a horse. And he later credited his fancy uniform, part of the diplomatic corps regalia, I guess, of this era, with wowing the droshky driver into, you know, kinder behavior. He found that when he attempted similar maneuvers back in New York, the drivers were not necessarily as deferential. But he really did have a conversion experience in this moment and decided to make the protection of animals his life's work. And from there, he really made a lot happen.
It's not the only moment in Europe, though, that changes his view. He attends a bullfight that really seems to alter the course of his life.
That's true. That was some years earlier. But I think especially in retrospect, once he really got involved in the cause, he saw this as another epiphany where he experienced waves of disgust, not only for what was happening to the animals down sort of in the competition space, if you want to call that, I'm not sure.
The arena?
The arena. But he really deplored the way that other spectators were reacting to the violence. He sort of became attached to this idea of cruelism, that abuse of animals isn't only awful because of its effect on the animal, or awful because of the action of, you know, the effect on the person carrying out the abuse, that was demoralizing too, but also bad morally for the people who observed it and didn't act. So that became a real sort of animating passion for him, the idea that people who abuse animals need to be punished and other people need to see that happening.
And although the idea of punishing people who abuse animals feels pretty commonplace today, we all sort of fundamentally understand that, he was considered quite radical by many in the mid-1800s. He was ridiculed, he was assaulted, he even had death threats.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that one of the things that that really impressed us as we researched this book was you know, often this generation of animal advocates is seen by today's animal rights activists as kind of squishes. They were patrician. They were too cozy with power, and they didn't go far enough. But it really did impress us just how radical some of what they did was seen at the time. I mean, the example that a lot of people discuss that we get into in the book is what's called the turtle case, which was, you know, there was a boatload of 100 or so sea turtles that had come up from Florida, and they had been shipped on their backs, and cords had been pierced through their flippers, and he, you know, boarded the ship and hauled off the captain. And at the time, the idea that you would invoke the power of law enforcement on behalf of turtles was seen as just crazy. At the time, a lot of people didn't even think of them as animals. They would say, oh, well, they're a fish. And I mean, just the weird categorization issues. But the point was that, you know, the sense that he had that any creature that could suffer really deserved the protection of the law was incredibly radical at the time.
Yeah, one of the wild facts of that story that really stuck out to me was that the ASPCA, the organization he founded, had the authority to arrest people for animal cruelty. I was like, what?
Yeah, I mean, that's it, and that was the model. I mean, it's worth mentioning that, you know, he gave his organization the name the American Society, but it actually only had law enforcement power in New York State. And so all around the country, other organizations started up on this same model, which was they went to their state legislature and got the power to go out essentially as private law enforcement and haul people in front of a judge.
Which is wild. I can't imagine the ASPCA having a police force nowadays. But the other thing I should note is that the captain of that ship was eventually declared innocent. So Berg doesn't win that trial, but it does make him and his cause instantly famous.
That's right. He really embraced publicity and sort of believed that idea that all publicity is good publicity, and was willing to do things that were embarrassing or prone to failure in the public eye just to attract headlines and attract the media to sort of be part of the conversation and be a focus of fervent discussion. And he was very successful at sort of manipulating the interests of the press of the time, who loved sensation and spectacle. And so he really did, you know, by following that principle, attract a lot of attention to his cause.
And to, you know, really place him within history, you write about how this is happening at a time when we're hunting both passenger pigeons and the buffalo to extinction, right? The buffalo, like, we're taking their skin and leaving the carcass to rot in the fields by the hundreds and the thousands.
That's right. The native species of America were under tremendous pressure during this era of industrialization and transportation technologies that could sort of ship carcasses of animals from the West to the East with ease and efficiency and at a low price, so that animal products from all over the country were in heavy trade, which really ultimately put several species, several sort of visible species in the way of extinction, but surely a whole bunch of species sort of invisible to us as we look back on this time. And because of Berg's attention to animals, or adjacent to it, was this growing, dawning realization that conservation of animal species in North America was essential if we were going to preserve them for future generations.
It's also happening at the same time that Reconstruction is going on, and in the wake of the Civil War. And what I find fascinating is that, you know, Europe ended slavery on their continent before us, and their animal rights movement started before us, as though one was a natural outgrowth of the other.
Yeah, it really is interesting, you know, that it, on one level, that it took so long to come to the United States, right? So the what becomes the Royal SPCA, the very first animal welfare organization, starts in the 1820s in England. And then it spreads to Europe, and you have, you know, 1830s, 1840s, these groups begin to crop up to the point that, you know, 1850s, 1860s, you have, you know, international meetings of these organizations going on in Europe, and yet there's no such organization in the United States. On another level, it makes sense, right? Because so much of the kind of humanitarian consciousness and activism in the United States is focused on abolition. And pretty much everybody who gets involved with animal welfare after the Civil War was to some degree or other an opponent of slavery, not necessarily, you know, really high profile, but you definitely feel the sort of the activist energy flow out of the victory of the Civil War into a number of other causes. And one of them is animal welfare.
Another central figure in the fight for animal rights that you highlight in the book is Caroline Earle White. She's one of the first women to found an animal protection organization. Can you tell us a little bit about her?
Yeah, I mean, so there are sort of three main figures that we write about in the book, Henry Berg, George Angel, who we could talk about a little later in Massachusetts. And then Caroline Earle White, who's the youngest of the three, who is essentially the driving force behind the founding of the Pennsylvania Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. And what's interesting is that at that point in the late 1860s, there are many, many women who are active in these humanitarian causes, but there's a real societal kind of prohibition against them assuming leadership. So she basically has to step aside as these sorts of, you know, graybeard men are installed as the leaders of the organization. By a couple decades later, you know, within these progressive circles, that has really changed. And she is the founder of the first anti-vivisection organization, i.e. to protest medical research on animals. And she basically remains the leader of that group and really moves more into the fore as the century moves on.
And doesn't she found, it's not a no-kill shelter, but it's a more humane animal shelter as well?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I think her most historic contribution, her and what was called the women's branch of the Pennsylvania SPCA, which was the group that wound up doing a lot of the most interesting work, they founded a humane animal shelter where, you know, animals were kept for longer, and they really paid attention to the question of euthanasia, you know, which is of course a controversial subject even today, but they actually did research in Europe where the humane movement was a little further along about which methods of euthanasia were most humane, and they really took that question seriously. And yeah, I think that they really deserve credit for the dawn of a different way of thinking about pounds and shelters.
One of the difficult things that I read in the book, I mean, there's a lot of difficult scenes within the book, especially the descriptions of animal cruelty. But one of them deals with, I think it's New York City and the way they handle their stray dogs. So, you know, when you talk about humane shelters, the city would gather up all its stray dogs in the afternoon and then drown them in these cages at the end of the day. And it's, oh my goodness, you know, I just have to think, it was hard to read. I have to imagine it was also hard to research and hard to write.
No, it's just heartbreaking. And, you know, today, thankfully, we're in an era that strives for no kill in animal sheltering. But this is the era before spay and neuter, when populations of roaming dogs and cats in cities were very difficult to sort of control numbers-wise. And so cities did resort to killing animals. And until Caroline Earle White sort of invited people to rethink how that was done, these were really just awful dispatches of large numbers of animals. And they, many of those animals were strays, but some of them were beloved pets whose owners just didn't have enough time to claim them.
And that's one of the dichotomies in the book that we'll definitely get to as the hour moves on, but that dogs in particular have always been sort of companions. They've always been beloved pets, and that even existed in this moment.
It really did. And we know people loved dogs prior to this awakening in terms of animal cruelty and animal welfare. But this also was a time, probably because of increased awareness about animal cruelty and animal welfare, that the dog became more, you know, part of the family. And I guess I should add to the list of important forces is urbanization and people living in smaller spaces away from sort of farm animals and other sort of contact with animals in the agricultural context. And they brought these pets into their homes and into their lives. And a lot of the sort of ways we demonstrate our attachment to our pets today, actually we see echoes of this back in the era that we're looking at. I mean, right down to those funny outfits. There were dog tailors. Then, as now, the media would sometimes poke fun at people's over sort of exuberant love for their pets and willing to buy weird things for them. But
I do love that we've been dressing up our dogs for centuries.
Yeah. Right? Me too.
That was Monica Murphy, one of the authors of Our Kindred Creatures, How Americans Came to Feel the Way We Do About Animals. Coming up, we're going to talk about George Angel and the campaign to win the hearts and minds of Americans. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking this hour about how animals made the shift from possessions to companions, the human movement for animal rights. Still with us are Monica Murphy and Bill Wozzeck, authors of Our Kindred Creatures, How Americans Came to Feel the Way They Do About Animals. We've been talking about outlawing animal cruelty and how the ASPCA once upon a time had law enforcement powers, but that was only one part of the equation. The other part was winning the hearts and minds of Americans. And that's where a man named George Thorndike Angel comes in. He founded the Massachusetts Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, but he also wages a strong campaign for the hearts of Americans. I was wondering if you could tell us about Black Beauty, the novel, and how it fits into the fight for animal rights.
So one of the remarkable things that a lot of people don't know about Black Beauty, which is, of course, this famous novel about horses, about working horses in England, it's written in the mid-1870s, is that it doesn't really become a worldwide sensation until the 1890s, which really happens because George Angel, who, as you said, was the founder of the Massachusetts SPCA, first sees the book, right? It's 13 years old. He gets a copy in his hands in 1890. And he immediately decides that this is just an incredible piece of evangelism that has to be gotten out to the world. And specifically, he thinks, you know, he long had been looking for a book that would do for the cause of cruelty to horses what the book Uncle Tom's Cabin did for the cause of slavery. So he gets his hands on a copy of Black Beauty, and he basically just starts pirating it. He has it reset in type. He begins printing copies of it by the tens of thousands and selling it through the MSPCA offices at a pretty low price. And very quickly, it surpasses the sales figures for Uncle Tom's Cabin in its first year, which was famously just a sensational novel in terms of sales. And people start translating it all around the world. And it really does become a massive hit.
And for those who don't know, Black Beauty is told from the point of view of a horse. So, and it's unique and different in that way, because one of the things I kept coming back to in the book, and I love, is when you think about it, animals don't communicate their pain to us with words. Now, they can scream, they can cry, they can do all kinds of other vocalizations, but this was about putting yourself sort of in the mind, like stepping into the shoes of a horse.
Yeah, it was very powerful. I mean, as far as I know, or as far as the researchers know, it really was the first novel to ever be told from the perspective of an animal, which today, you know, we think of as kind of old hat, especially in children's literature. I mean, and I think that's one of the reasons why we now think of Black Beauty basically as a book for children. But at the time, it was widely praised by adults, you know, in the context of an adult audience. And in fact, people found this innovation of an animal telling you his story to be just really mind-boggling, and it affected people. It unsettled them because, of course, at the time, these working horses were all around making no sound, and this gave them a voice.
Yeah, I think of today, Charlotte's Web or Babe, even Call of the Wild comes out a couple of years after Black Beauty hit. So it is a whole genre to itself now.
Yeah. The one of the first kind of moves that George Angel made in this kind of lifelong campaign to evangelize kindness to animals was he started a magazine through the MSPCA that was called Our Dumb Animals, which sort of has a hilarious kind of off-key sound to it today. But this really was a huge talking point of the activists of this era, that animals are unable to speak for themselves, and so we need to speak on their behalf.
You know, I thought what struck me about it is I think connecting with people's emotions is critical to any movement, any fight for any kind of right. This may be a weird place that my brain went, but I thought about the fight for gay marriage. You know, at the beginning, it was very much about rights and equality and level playing field. But then it really seemed to take off when the message shifted to love is love, like that push for connection to the human emotion.
Yeah, we agree, actually. We, in some, in while we were writing the book, we were really thinking about the question, what made this social movement succeed when other deserving causes that were sort of being fought at the same time didn't take off the same way? And moreover, like, what makes social movements in general then and now succeed where other deserving ones fail? It's a really interesting question. We hope to answer it and lay the blueprint for progressive causes from here on. But it turns out it's really complicated. But I do think you're right that sort of touching people's hearts is a really important way that movements sort of get momentum.
I even think to that, I grew up with those, I can't remember the name of the singer now, in the Arms of the Angel ads with the dogs being heard and the music plays and it asks you to be an angel for the animal. And I was like, it's so hard to watch, but it gets you.
Absolutely.
I think that was a really successful ad for the ASPCA, if I'm remembering right. It brought in a lot of money.
Yeah, it's famous. So I feel like as we've been talking about the book, this is not the first time that ad has come up. So it definitely touched a lot of hearts.
You know, in talking about the complicated, sometimes messy fight for any sort of right, I want to talk about the controversial figure that is P.T. Barnum, because he's another big character in your book. And he actually has an important role to play in the fight for animal rights, which surprised me. I was hoping you could describe Barnum's influence on the American imagination and the way Americans thought about animals.
Yeah, Barnum is such an interesting figure. So disturbing in the way he handled a lot of sensitive issues involving the sort of commercialization of humans and their idiosyncrasies, but also in how he sort of displayed and promoted animals, because his eagerness to get animals in front of Americans and in particular urban Americans like New Yorkers, where he had his first museum, was maybe coming from a place of fascination and affection towards animals. I do think he liked them. And animals were a huge investment for him and his entertainments. And so I think he did his very best to preserve their longevity and good health. But the capture and transport and confinement of the animals in his museums and circuses was really, really brutal. And yet, when those animals sort of took the stage, he gave them names and he gave them personalities and he gave people sort of a way in to appreciate charismatic wild animals from around the world. And in doing so, I do think he actually ended up bringing people into the animal cause, but he also gave Henry Berg a convenient sort of focus for some highly public battles about how animals should be treated. And Barnum, like Berg, believed all publicity was good publicity. So I do think it was a fascinating relationship where they really, those two men really relished their public fights. And by battling out about how to feed snakes or how to train elephants, they brought more attention to animal causes, certainly, even if some of it was sort of perverse, and there were definitely animal suffering while these guys, you know, sort of jostled for headlines.
Yeah, I love that they would even publish some of their correspondent in order to shame the other. Like, it's almost, they don't like each other, but they need each other in some way in this moment.
They're frenemies, right?
Like, oh, that's a great way to describe it.
And I think each expressed some affection for the other at various points along the way. And Barnum, despite everything, considered himself an animal advocate. He was very proud to be on the board of the Bridgeport, Connecticut SPCA.
Oh, that's wild.
Mm-hmm. And when Berg died, there was Barnum at the funeral, named amongst the prominent attendees. He actually paid for a monument to be erected to Berg in Bridgeport after Berg's death. Berg definitely seems susceptible to the charms of Barnum. I think we have some correspondence from him talking about a pleasant visit to Bridgeport and eating clams at his fancy house. So these guys had a really interesting love hate, like using one another for their own specific needs, sort of thing. And it's wonderful that they did it in the newspapers, so that we can sort of get inside that today.
Yeah, at the end of the book, I really couldn't decide how to feel about Barnum. He was undeniably cruel to his animals, but he also helped us reimagine how we see them. He almost made us think of them as special, as worthy of individual consideration.
I agree with you. I want to despise Barnum because I hate what he did to elephants. I hate what he did to beluga whales. I really don't think any of the animals who came under his care benefited from that association in any way. I worry, too, about a lot of the humans who were part of Barnum's empire. But Barnum is, of all the people we researched, he's the best writer. He's the funniest. He's wonderful to sort of follow his career through his many elaborate autobiographies. And so it's hard to have like simple feelings about Barnum.
I mean, another thing that's remarkable about Barnum is that, you know, good information about how to care for these animals in captivity could be hard to find. But Barnum always took care to hire the people who knew the most. Often when he and Berg would fight, Berg was sometimes kind of had the right instincts morally, but Barnum often knew more about, or his people knew more about the animals in question.
And what they needed and how to sort of preserve their health and help them live as long as possible.
Yeah, bringing an elephant to the United States was incredibly expensive. I mean, this was like, not to be crass about it, but it was a huge investment for him.
It was. Partly because for every elephant that made it onto Barnum's stage, there were, you know, many, many members of the herd that were slaughtered in order to capture that one elephant. Many of the elephants died in transit. And so you have this like awful pyramid where the one elephant that's named and paraded before children throughout America represents just populations of elephants laid to waste. But it's absolutely true that that one elephant, Jumbo, it's a named animal with a personality and a lot of, you know, a whole army of people taking care of him and trying to keep him, you know, sort of functioning so that he can continue to tour the United States by rail and delight families such as it was.
Yeah, I mean, it's wild to think about, but a lot of fairs and circuses and all these places would even sometimes have baskets on the elephants and the kids could get in and ride. It was about getting up and close with an animal you never, ever, ever would have seen otherwise.
That's right. People were able to get very close to the animals. And I do think that in small town America, that advent of the sort of railway circus, which would whisk these, you know, very charismatic large animals from around the world into your small town. It must have seemed like a miracle. You know, every circus day started with a parade down the middle of Main Street. And I think in that like humdrum like environment that you occupy maybe your whole life to see elephants and giraffes and, you know, all sorts of amazing animals and people sort of parading right through town must have really just been an amazing experience. I mean, certainly people reminisced about it for decades afterwards.
And this is also the time when photography is getting off the ground. So it's not commonplace. It's not something you see a lot of. So when we're talking about, you know, every child knows what a giraffe looks like by the time they go to kindergarten. But that wasn't the case in the 1880s.
Yeah, that's right. And it meant a lot to people to be able to not only see, but often reach out and touch these animals. And when we think about, you know, sort of broadly speaking, how people felt about animals and in during this time period, I do think this did have real impact alongside, you know, the horses that powered their cities and the, you know, dogs that maybe were sleeping by their fireplace. These animals suddenly became real to everybody.
Another topic you touch on in the book is zoos, the creation of zoos, the evolution of zoos from these like concrete metal bar enclosures to habitats. And I, you know, zoos are always something that is controversial even today.
That's right. But I thought it was really interesting because I feel like in my lifetime, I've seen zoo enclosures go from being, you know, often kind of awful to better. That even back in the 1890s, there was deep consideration starting to be given to how to display animals in a way that is sort of naturalistic so that the people viewing the animals can imagine them in their natural habitat rather than just a caged animal just there for their sort of to visually take in. But also what allowing the animals themselves to perform behaviors that are more natural, more equivalent to what they would have done in the wild. And the founding of the Bronx Zoo is really, and the Smithsonian, those two zoos really did put forward the idea that you could have animals on display in cities from far-flung places, but do so in a way that sort of provides some context about how animals are meant to live.
I would also add, I do think that this we kind of write about this transformation sort of close to the end of the book, and I do think this is a double-edged sword, right? I think that on one level, you would certainly rather be a zoo, or sort of rather be an animal in a contemporary zoo versus one of these, you know, very old-fashioned zoos with the cages. On another level, I think that, to be frank, like the contemporary zoo, by presenting the animals more naturalistically, allows viewers simultaneously to try to imagine that these animals are in a kind of simulation of a real habitat and feel less bad about the fact that there are sort of fundamental levels in which they're being housed in climates and in situations that are just utterly unsuitable for them. I mean, and even just the isolation of being, you know, one of a couple when often they might, or they might range, or there's so many ways in which like being in a zoo is just so unnatural. And there is a degree to which, I mean, not that I think this is the reason for it, or that anybody who runs one of these contemporary zoos is cynical about this question, but that these more naturalistic enclosures kind of allow the whole enterprise of the zoo to feel like a little bit more appropriate than it really is.
We're talking with the authors of Our Kindred Creatures this hour, how Americans came to feel the way they do about animals. Coming up, the contradictions within the animal welfare movement. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7. NPR News. Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking this hour about our ever-evolving relationship with animals. Still with us are the authors of a new book, Monica Murphy and Bill Wozniak, who wrote Our Kindred Creatures, How Americans Came to Feel the Way They Do About Animals. You tell some really complex stories in this book, stories that are full of contradictions and morally gray characters. And I love that because I think it's so easy to simplify movements into clear battles between good and evil, to write them in linear ways that make the ending seem inevitable when the truth is always so much messier. And I just want to say kudos because I really loved that about how complicated not only the people are, but their beliefs are about animals.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, the subtitle of the book is How Americans Came to Feel the Way They Do About Animals. And really what we mean by that is the sort of complex kind of group of attitudes that we tend to hold, where, you know, dogs and cats are now essentially members of the family. And then we've developed a certain kind of awareness, but at a distance, about conservation and certain wild animals. But then, of course, on issues like, industrial meat and dairy production, there are these, you know, massive sort of shadow realms of animals where we're able to sort of use these animals directly or indirectly without necessarily having to think about how they're treated and whether we have any obligation to them. So it isn't just a positive story by any means. It's about a kind of bifurcation or multiplefurcation of the way we think about different species.
Yeah, because the era of the animal rights movement that you're chronicling is also the era when industrial meat production takes off. So I wonder, what do you think is the dividing line there? Why is it just the animals we could see and the animals that were essentially hidden from us? How are these two things unfolding at the same time?
You know, I think it's obviously complicated. Like, I think that you know, there are some animals intrinsically who we have a connection with that transcends just, you know, a concern for their welfare, like the dog being the obvious historic example.
Well, and the horse, to
yes,
the people were
right.
Writing about, the horse was very much front and center in their lives. I do think that, going back to Henry Berg, our founder of this movement, his idea of cruelism that does prioritize the animals we see being abused, because he not only cares about what's happening to animals, but he really, really cares that no one be allowed to abuse them in public and that other people be allowed to watch.
Yeah, Berg has, I kind of, you know, those Richard Scarry children's books where it's like the town is this like self-contained, well, and they're all animals, which complicates the matter. But I feel like Berg has this very kind of Richard Scarry view of society, which is everybody's wandering around town and has an obligation to make sure that cruelty isn't happening in their town. And there's something about the idea that off in Chicago, there are like millions of cows being like raised and slaughtered and their meat is shipped to you. And where does the obligation that you might have if you're purchasing, or even if you're not, that meat, what is your obligation to how those cows were treated? I mean, he was capable of thinking about that. All these activists were capable of thinking about that, but it really challenged, I think, their basic model for how they thought. And it really challenged the model for these societies, which were very much based on tips coming in from concerned citizens, or you're just sort of out wandering the streets. But a lot of this industrial meat production, as that arises, that sort of creates almost these like whole cities of meat production where there aren't any animal activists walking around, right? Everybody who's there are people who are basically part of that industry. And that really challenges the basic model.
Yeah, I was thinking about that because, you know, slaughterhouses at the time that this is happening aren't safe for humans either, right? The FDA doesn't exist. OSHA doesn't exist. It's not until Upton Sinclair's The Jungle towards the tail end of this movement that we actually start to think about like what life is like in those slaughterhouses.
Yeah, I mean, in that book, right, and 1906, which kind of is past the period that we're looking at, but when that book comes out, it really does change the slaughterhouses. Ironically, of course, because of the implications of some of the passages in that book about the safety of eating the meat, and what Upton Sinclair really wanted to do was to shine a light on the labor practices, but just like today, people sort of worrying about their own health is the thing that's the most kind of sensational and viral. And but that does lead to some real changes, including some positive changes for the animals.
Yeah, I'll never forget the scene in that book. I had to read it in high school. I think most people like get it through their education. But the scene in the book where the guy falls into the vat and goes out and becomes part of the meat that's sold. Ugh, the internal cringe from that has never gone away. But, you know, I think that just highlights the delicate and complicated nature of all movements. A lot of this feels like two steps forward, one step back. We do this, but we don't do that. It's really easy to see how the story of the fight for animal rights looks a lot like the story for any other kind of right.
No, I think that's right. And I would say one of the big macro transformations that happens during this period we write about is that everything becomes bigger. Like there's more people. The railroads create more distance between sort of cause and effect or various things that are happening. The economy becomes more nationalized, and then of course later becomes more globalized. And I do think this question of systemic problems, which I feel like, on one level, problems were always systemic, but there is this sort of fundamental way that modernity has made problems sort of more systemic because everything is so bigger and more interconnected. And that really is, I think, the challenge that sort of comes up with a lot of these issues during this time period. And I frankly think that it's true of a lot of the problems that we face today. I mean, climate change being the most obvious one.
You know, we talked in the beginning about Berg, who founds the ASPCA. He has this conversion when he intercedes on behalf of a horse that's being beaten by its driver. And, you know, you'd like to say that this isn't the kind of thing that happens today. But, you know, just yesterday we saw British Olympian Charlotte Dujardin. I'm hoping I'm saying that correctly. This Olympian pulls out of this year's games after a video of her beating her horse came to light.
Wow. Well, I do think, though, the reaction to that video is very much sort of a product of this movement, because imagine a world in which someone beating their horse It's just a big, you know, commonplace event, a big yawn, nothing to see here. The fact that people are shocked and horrified and talking about it, I mean, that goes back to these people we're writing about who wanted to live in a world in which that was just vilified, and they succeeded.
Yeah. I wonder where you come down on the, I guess I'm just curious, as somebody who has now researched and written this book about the how we treat animals in this country, where do you come down on things like meat and dairy?
I mean, it's complicated. I mean, I think it's worth saying we didn't come to this project thinking of ourselves as animal rights activists by any means. I think we really came to it as people interested in the history of how animals were treated.
Animal lovers.
Yeah. I think I saw a pet in the background here as we were talking now and again.
I think that certainly for me, when I was like researching the stuff about the rise of the industrial meat industry, you really kind of realize how the sense of separation, right, of this, of in scale, that just the sheer scale of the animals who are caught up in this system on the one hand, and on the other hand, the just distance, both kind of in the literal sense and the kind of more metaphorical sense of them from our consciousness, it just really strikes me as a problem that like we need to bridge, that everybody, whatever, wherever you wind up coming down on the question of, you know, eating milk or eggs or dairy, that you need to understand not just sort of how the animals are being treated, but you also need to really think about the ease with which we, you know, go to the grocery store and pick up something that was made from them, the distance that, you know, the fact that they exist out there in the world, and they exist in incredibly large numbers, and they live and they die by the millions, and we need to spare a thought for them if we're going to continue using them. And of course, I think we need to move radically towards improving their treatment.
Yeah, because most of us can do better. We can do better. Most people can. A few people are there. Good for them. But you know, and the same applies to issues of conservation. We think climate change is, in addition to being, you know, critical to human survival, critical to animals as well. And so there's room for improvement for everybody on that front. And so I hope that even though we don't write this as an animal rights sort of declaration, we're really just trying to tell a story of how we got to now, essentially. I do hope it invites people to examine, you know, these systems and the ways that they are implicated in them and make positive changes.
Yeah, it is really easy not to think about it when you go to the grocery store, but I mean, there's a lot of videos out there that will really turn your stomach if you go looking for them. I mean, there's a lot of controversy just about, let's say, chicken and the way, you know, chickens are raised in the dark, their beaks are sheared, the way in which they are kept for their lives before they're slaughtered, and whether that should matter to us as the consumers of that chicken.
That's right. And those videos, I guess, mean that, you know, if Henry Berg were with us now, he'd be forced to think of the cruelism that, you know, is being carried out since these videos exist and we can watch them and choose to act or to ignore it. It would really enlarge his thinking, I think.
Yeah, I wonder what he would think of social media. Actually, I'm a little scared to think of P.T. Barnum in social media.
Oh,
but
wow. Yeah. He would have loved it.
That's probably true. He'd probably have a really big following.
That's absolutely right.
You know, I do want to ask. So you are a married couple and you are co-authors now of two books. Is that ever hard, writing with your partner?
It's great.
Yeah, we've really liked it.
Good.
we get this question a lot from other couples, and I think that you know, it's just a matter of sort of finding the balance of kind of which part each of us is going to take the lead on, and then finding, and then reading and editing each other's work. I think it's been a harmonious partnership.
Yeah, I think it's wonderful to have a shared project. I mean, we raised a boy. That's, you know,
another shared project.
But this one's going to keep going. So it's really wonderful. I hope everyone can find something like this to share with the people they love, because I think it really is a wonderful way to relate to one another.
That was Monica Murphy. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you.
And thank you to Bill Wazig.
Oh, thanks.
They are the co-authors of Our Kindred Creatures, How Americans Came to Feel the Way They Do About Animals. It's available for purchase online and at major book retailers across the U.S. Thank you so much for joining me, and thank all of you for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.